Roxic, Hyproxic Paradox. That came from the study where 35 adults over the age of 64 were involved in the study and were administered hyperbaric oxygen therapy, HBOT, utilizing 100% oxygen in an environmental pressure higher than one absolute atmosphere, the amount of oxygen dissolved in the body tissues. Every 20 minutes, the participants were asked to remove their mask for 5 minutes, bringing their oxygen back to the normal level. However, during this period, researchers saw that fluctuations in the free oxygen concentration were interpreted as the cellular level, as a lack at the cellular level, as the lack of oxygen, rather than interpreting the absolute level of oxygen. Interesting study. There was in the link that I have sent you, you're going to see the chamber. It's a big, huge cylinder, approximately 100 feet long, and you have people sitting there comfortably. The practical ramifications include improvement in attention, information processing, speed and executive function. There are plenty of positive outcomes from that technique. And also, it is reversible disease technique that was studied there, as well as a target aging reversible. I'm trying to quickly say what it says in here.
Yeah, Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I see it seems to be a problem. It doesn't reverse any disease. The quote I think that you're pulling it from is something along the lines of, it gives hope and opens the door for a lot of young scientists to target aging as a reversible disease. All that it apparently does is it increases the length of something in DNA called the telomere. I hate to go back to genetics, but one of the little interesting things about DNA molecules is at either end it has things called telomeres. And when the cell line is very young, the telomeres are very, very long. And every time that the DNA replicates, it seems to snip a little bit off the telomere. So that's how you can sort of tell an old cell line from a new cell line. And the principal findings, according to this article, are that the telomeres of the DNA of some cells that were involved with these people with these hyperbaric oxygen treatments regrew, so they lengthen. Whether this correlates to anything about cell life is not really proven.
Thank you very much for that. Can I go to another one?
Yeah, sure.
Sweating is a natural function of the human body, allowing a body to cool itself as sweat emerges from glands and evaporates. Separately, this process may produce odors as bacteria present on the skin break down sweat proteins. A desodorant kills the bacteria that produce odor, while an antiperspirant clogs sweat ducts to prevent sweat from emerging in the first place. The Virginia Tech Nature Inspired Fluids at Interfaces Lab, led by Associate Professor Jonathan Borrico, has just made a major breakthrough in the study of natural antiperspirants. The theory is, if the sweat can begin to evaporate while still inside of the sweat duct, before it emerges onto the skin, the sweat's own minerals will crystallize to plug the duct. In other words, the mixture of sodium chloride, potassium, calcium, urea, and bacteriobacarbonate, naturally present in sweat, can do the same work as the metallic salts used in commercial antiperspirants. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I was trying to reach that link that you sent me, and I keep getting back to the Israeli scientists with their hyperbaric chambers.
Yeah, well, they claim they have a proof of concept. Three different scenarios with tests. The first was a control where no product was placed near artificial sweat duct. For the second test, researchers placed a dry tube of organic silicon-based polymer, PDMS, near the exit of the duct. Finally, they the third test is PDMS cube was infused with polypropylene glycol, a chemical that is highly attractive to water. Those three scenarios allowed for the direct comparison of how sweat followed when the duct was completely open versus near a regular object versus near an evaporation inducting object. Dr. Rook.
Okay, it's an interesting study. We'll see if it comes to anything. We'll see if any company can make a buck off of it, most likely.
And the last one. Dog training methods help researchers tech robots to learn new tricks. In Johns Hopkins University, with a training technique commonly used to take dogs to sit and stay, computer scientists showed a robot how to teach itself several new tricks, including sucking blood. With the method the robot named Spot was able to learn in days what typically takes months. Let me just with a few words say what is it about. When we train the dog, we have something what dogs want, and that would be some food, some meat, anything that they want. But before we give it to them, we require from them to perform certain tricks. The same story is with robots. Scientists were able to make robots to need something, to earn something, and before they were rewarded with some kind of reward, they had to perform. So the computer code and algorithm must of perform and show the new something that wasn't taught before. Let me jump. There is a quote, Hunt recalled how he once taught his terrier mixed puppy named Let the command leave it, so she could ignore squirrels on the walk. He used two types of threats, original trainer threats and something even better, like cheese. When Let was excited and sniffing around the threat, she got nothing. But when she calmed down and looked away, she got the good stuff. That was, I gave her the cheese, and I said, leave it. Similarly, the stock block that was on the table, the robot needed to learn how to focus on constructive action. As the robot explored the blocks, it quickly learned that correct behavior for stacking earned high points, but incorrect ones earned nothing. Reach out, but don't grasp a block. No points. Knock over a stack? Definitely no points. Spot earned the most by placing the last block on the top of a four block. So, that training of robot earning points not only work, it took just days to teach the robot what used to take a week. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's how artificial intelligence tends to work. You have a feedback loop that reinforces more optimal solutions to problems. The thing that I found kind of fascinating was the creative idea of labeling that paper that you're citing. The title of it was apparently called Good Robot.
Oh, yeah. In regards to that, the team of scientists imagined that the household robot could be trained to do laundry and wash dishes, tasks that could be popular on the open market and help seniors live independently. It could also help design improve self-driving cars. And now we coming back to the first subject that I was talking about today, which is the CarGo by K-A-R-Go from United Kingdom. There was a time in 2012-2013, I had a project to create a route or to track based on artificial points. So I was able to make a net from not existing points, but those not existing points were mathematically assigned to the space, and a camera could follow those not existing points while the building was moving was raising up, or a drone was, or small helicopter at that time, was moving in the space. It was following that helicopter was following the points in its route. Then I gave up. The one thing for it is just that I'm interested with something new, always something new. And when I get to the certain point, I have to either patent it or give it up. And patent for something like a paperclip is $20,000. I just don't want to waste my life for it. And to extra it.
Well, that's understandable, Wesley. Patents are curious devices. Even if you patent things, then you need the resources of a good lawyer if it's a valuable patent, because invariably someone will try to skirt it or modify it slightly or in some way game the system.
With everything that I said today, the only first part, which is that car that doesn't use the GPS, was something that was really amazing to me, as it was based on the car that is showing up in the middle of nowhere for the car, and memorizing a certain point, and then is creating a net of points from nothing, just by a camera looking at what is there. And then I was able to recognize the lines, was able to keep on the right side, on the left side in England. Any people were crossing by, was able to recognize those people and do not and stop safe. That is amazing. Thank you very much for the science panel.
You're welcome, Wesley. Once again, I want to remind everyone that if they can't get onto the technical net and they have questions or if they have topics or if they have puzzles or if they want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have to take a look at a space-related story, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And as always, take a look at the link page after we're done with the technical net tonight. You can find it by just typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. And always want to remind people, Mike's wonderful archive of the technical net going back to 2006, and that's at amateurradio.tv. And thanks to everyone who participated for this portion of the technical net. Now I would like to call upon Paul WS2N with the space report.
Okay, AC2GS WS2N. And, okay, on everything so far, not very good. And I just, one of the things I was going to talk about was this launch tonight, but that's been scrubbed until tomorrow evening. If you do bring up the webcast for SpaceX, it's always amazing to watch this thing land right dead center, usually right on a drone ship out at sea. Like I said, Friday night they had a launch from Florida, and then they had a boost to land on land there. They brought it right back to right, I think it's around 1,500 feet away from the launch pad. Okay, there's going to be a little crack here. Okay, there's going to be an ISS sighting tomorrow night. It'll be 5:30, 5:32 exactly to 5:38. So it'll pass over Long Island, New York City for 6 minutes. It will be about 46 degrees above the horizon, traveling from the west to the northeast, and it'll be a minus 3.2 magnitude, which is very bright. The lower the number, so if you have like a minus 4 or something, that's even brighter, which we had on Friday night. It was a wonderful pass. It came, started low on the horizon and went right up to zenith of the house. It looked right up, and the program I have said it would flick out at that time because it was going to lose the sun, and sure enough, it did. That was roughly a 3 minute pass, but very brightest I have ever seen. It was a minus 4 magnitude. And to give you an idea, if you were to look at the sun, that's a minus 27 magnitude. So each one is, it's a logarithmic system. But usually you could see them at 1.2 or something of minus 1.2 or better. You could always see the space station go by. And tomorrow night it's supposed to be a clear night, so it should be good. Just drop it. If anybody had any questions on that, I'll move on. Okay, and by the way, I use the ISS detector. That's the app I use. There's a bunch of them out there, but that's the one I use. So it's good. You put it into your phone or into your tablet, and off you go. It'll give you updates. It'll let you know 5 minutes before the ISS goes by. Pretty good. The crew that was launched last week crew of four hams successfully docked with the International Space Station last week. You know, I got covered the launch, but then the next day, 27 hours later, they did successfully docked. All autonomous. The crew does not have to touch anything. It does it on its own. They could take over if they have to. I mean, from launch until it's docked. It will stay there now 6 months until it undocks and eventually comes back to Earth. So they now have a permanent group on the International Space Station of seven people. So this was our Launch Complex 39, Michael Hopkins, Victor Glover, Shannon Walker, and the Japanese from JAXA, from the Japanese Space Agency, Sochi, Nagoshi, flew on that Falcon 9 up to the space station. And they met up with Kate Rubens, another amateur radio operator, she's got a license, and two Russians. Their spaceship is the Soyuz spacecraft, and that's docked to the space station. They've been up there for about a month. So I'll get a lot of science done with that extra man up there. That really helps. They predict the amount of science that will come back will be about twice the amount than what they have been doing. So there is another crew vehicle that's going to be docking there probably within a couple of months. That's called the Starliner, being built by Boeing. That will also have the capability to bring a crew up, but this one will be no crew whatsoever. They tried to do this about 8 months ago, 9 months ago, and the spacecraft it was their first test to bring it up to the space station. It's got to dock and then eventually undock, and come back and land in the New Mexico area. But that didn't work out. They had some problems with the computers. The timing of them weren't matched with one another. And they went short of fuel and all kinds of problems. So they brought it back, and now they're going to do it again to make NASA happy. Boeing is going to fly the same, same Starliner up to the space station and back down again. If that is successful, they'll be able to continue with that, with actually bringing a crew up, in the near future after that. But maybe actually probably about 6 months, because I know SpaceX has another crew launch coming up as well. But, to make a long story short, eventually we're going to have two rockets, different rockets, two different spacecraft, each being able to carry four people up to the space station on a regular basis. And of course, if anybody ever gets the idea to build more space stations, we'll have the capability to do that. There's those plans that are on the drawing board somewhere down the line. These spacecraft and rockets will have some place to go. Let me drop it. Anyway, they named the spacecraft Resilience. They like that name because of what's been going on with COVID down here, and nothing stopped these people. It slowed them down, but it didn't stop them from continuing to develop the Crew Dragon spacecraft. And it looks a little different than the cargo vehicles that have gone up before, the Dragon cargo vehicles when they docked to the space station. They have solar panels sticking out. This does not have that. It has solar panels attached to the body of the spacecraft on one half of it. And the other half, they have radiators to get rid of the heat from inside the spacecraft. Once they're docked, they don't need that power. They pick up the power from the solar panels, mass solar panels that are attached to the space station. Space station has plenty of power to spare. They have the capability of, if you had 40 homes up there, they would be able to supply all 40 homes with power. Drop it. SpaceX in Mission Control, which is located in Hawthorne, California. That's where where everything is controlled from. You know, we do have Houston involvement as well, because they're watching the space station crew, and Hawthorne, which is SpaceX, watching the vehicle go up to the space station. But they had some problems with the fuel heating system. You know, they have to keep the fuel for the thrusters. The thrusters, it's a hypergolic fuel they have. They mix monomethyl hydrazine with the nitrogen tetroxide. So, you know, when the two come in contact, they instantly ignite. But to do that, they need to keep the fuel, you know, above a certain degree temperature. I think it's, they like to keep it above 60 degrees. They have these heaters that heat the fuel tanks, and they set the limits on it a little off, you know. So when they realized that they were not at the right temperature, Hawthorne, and not the crew, Hawthorne was able to readjust the settings and bring the heaters back online. So, you know, essentially it's like setting a thermostat at the wrong temperature. So everything worked fine. The temperatures never went below 75 degrees Fahrenheit, and they kept well above the limit of 60 degrees. And of course, those thrusters, without them, you know, you'd never be able to change your attitude in space. And, you know, so they all have to be functioning. And they had some problems with the temperature inside the spacecraft as well. The thermal controls were a little off. And again, Hawthorne was able to readjust them as well. I did see the crew did give a news conference at that event. Lasted about 25 minutes, 20 minutes or so. And they were inside their spacecraft, traveling to the International Space Station, transmitting down to Earth beautiful pictures of the crew. And they were able to sleep on board for, like I said, it took 27 hours. And there's quite a bit of room. They gave you a tour. You know, once you're in microgravity, it's like the space in that area doubles. You know, there's no more floor anymore. Everything is just you know, open and float around, and plenty of room. It worked out very good. So I was glad to see them be able to dock with the space station. Let me drop it. Okay. Any comments on Crew Dragon or the four amateur radio operator ham? Astronauts that have actually docked with the space station. If not, we'll move on.
WB2GXM.
N2X.
2H, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Paul. Good evening. I thought I heard Wesley mention, he was talking about the time there was that hole in the air leak in the space station. And I believe I heard him mention that there was a cosmonaut that they had sent up who, I guess, wasn't very stable mentally or something like that. So I hadn't heard any of this. Did you hear that? Maybe give me a little background on that, if that were the case.
Okay. I heard him say something about an air leak. I'm having a hard time copying Wesley some of the time. So, they've never admitted to anybody in particular doing that. And the guy that's running Roscosmos, is, you know, what NASA is to the space program, Roscosmos is to the Russian space program. The guy that's running that, Rodigin, he was one of these oligarchs from Russia. They used to have another guy in there, and pushed him out and put this guy in. And so, you know, if he did say something like that, I'd be surprised. And if you did, I wouldn't necessarily believe it. So, I think whoever did that must have been, I'm going to guess it's some kind of an act. They must have been drilling and drill here, and it must have went right through, and they just never admitted to who did it. I have not heard anything about that blue whatsoever. Back to you.
All right, Paul, very good, thank you.
Yeah, it was a small hole, I think, just a couple of millimeters diameter hole. And then after they found it, the Russians did an EVA, and they went to the outside of that orbital module, and they had to get rid of all this insulation. You know, NASA would have, had some kind of tool or something, neatly removed it, and eventually got to the outside to see what it looked like on the outside of the spacecraft. These two Russians, they had a sheetrock pipe, it looked like. I mean, they ripped the stuff apart, pieces were flying through space, and what a butcher job they were doing. And I guess they eventually got down to the metal surface to see what it looked like. But I was crazy about the way they handled that. And nevertheless, it's the orbital section. So, the Soyuz spacecraft has three pieces to it. You have the orbital section, you have the launch and descent module, and that's in the middle. And then you've got the service module at the back with the engines and the fuel supply and all of that. And when they come back from the space station and they're going to enter the atmosphere, these three pieces, right before they hit the atmosphere, they separate from one another. So they don't need the service module anymore. That goes away. And that exposes the descent module with the heat shield. And then the top piece is the orbital section. The reason they need that anyway is, if you look at how tight they are sitting in the descent module, they're right on top of each other. You don't have enough room to breathe. And, when they do get to orbit, they leave those chairs and they go through they have a hatch they go through into the orbital module, which is bigger. They have a bathroom facility with a place to eat. And they can hang out there for days on end if they need. They need to get to the space station. So they don't need that orbital module. So that piece, that was gone. So that wasn't the part that had the hole drilled through it. So when they came through the atmosphere, it was just like any other re-entry. Safely came through. Heat shield separation, big parachute comes down, drogue parachute, and then the big parachute comes down. The three of them landed safely in the Kazakhstan desert, so naturally they're not able to retrieve that module. Gone, the orbital module. So nobody could do any further inspections on that little hole. That's the story on the leak gun. It took them quite a while to find it. Recently, they found another leak in the Zvezda module. That's a big module attached to the space station, again, on the Russian side. And they say it's like a hairline crack. I think I covered this last week or the week before. And they've been looking for it for months. They know the pressure's been slightly dropping. It's started to increase. So they looked harder and harder. They closed off countless doors between different modules. There's got to be a dozen modules, different types on the space station. And they eventually tracked it down to the final module, which is the Russian Zvezda module. That's where the Russians eat, they sleep. They knew it was there. They closed the doors and left the module. They couldn't find it. They couldn't. They used ultrasonic detecting stuff that they had set up on one of the missions. That wasn't working. So one of the Russians got the bright idea, let's take some tea leaves, just tiny, they have tea up there. So they open up a pack of tea, and very fine. Leave it on the
one spot, and then they went and, you know, closed up the module. And sure enough, eventually the tea leaves started to migrate to one area in the Zesman module, and they did find the leak. They temporarily sealed it. But on a future mission, they're going to send up better stuff to make it more permanent seal. I'm curious to see what kind of a crack we're talking about. We're talking about a quarter inch, or is it 6 inches long, or, you know, I haven't heard any details on that yet. You know, what are they going to be trying to repair here? So, very good. All right, let me continue on, unless anybody has any questions.
I don't think so.
Okay. Heard two stations, but you doubled perfectly. Which station? Try again.
WB2GXM.
That's
yeah, I heard GXM first. Go ahead.
Thank you, Paul. WB2GXM, Rich. I'm curious, how is Dragon going to re-enter the atmosphere? Is it in the manner of Apollo or Gemini? How does that all work?
They went back to that type of system. So yeah, when Dragon separates from, undocks from the International Space Station, they'll have the crew of four back in there, and as they'll use their onboard thrusters to slow themselves down, and when they get near the, relatively near the atmosphere, the trunk, the back part of, will separate. You know, right now the whole spacecraft from nose to the bottom of the trunk is 27 feet. And roughly half of that is what they call the trunk. And it's an unpressurized area. In fact, in the back they could hold, payloads. They've done that before, you know, telescopes and things like that. To be able to, when they dock to the space station, they could use the robotic arm on the space station to, well, you know, take that out of the trunk and attached to the space station. Well, that trunk, in this case, with the crew module, it consists of from the crew part of the vehicle, and that again will expose the heat shield. They call it a Pica X heat shield. It's derived from NASA technology. Without NASA, the technology, Elon Musk is, you know, he would have been in big trouble. So he took their heat shield and he just improved on it a bit. And they call it Pica. It's called Pica for NASA. And you know, they're going to use that on their Orion spacecraft. And he took it and readapted it for the use of not only the the crew vehicle. So yeah, that comes through the atmosphere, and then he's got couple of drogue chutes that come out, and they pull out four big parachutes. And he had a lot of trouble with the design. They tested these things, I think, like 50 different times. You know, they dropped them out of cargo vehicles, cargo. You know, one flight after the other, and they finally got approved by NASA. These four big parachutes come out, and your goal is to land it in the Atlantic Ocean, where SpaceX has their own ship. And the crew will stay in the vehicle and, you know, float around the ocean for a while. And the SpaceX ship has this hydraulic lift type of thing. It's going to grab a hold of the top of it. So they'll attach it. You know, they'll have a crew go out in little boats, attach it to the big ship. It hydraulically will pick the whole thing up, put it onto the bed of the ship, and they open a hatch and bring out the four astronauts. That's exactly what I told you they did with the crew two that went up last May, and that was Bob Behnken and Hurley. That's how they went up to the space station. They only stayed for like almost 2 months, and then came back. And they were supposed to land in the Atlantic Ocean, but they had a storm out there at the time. So
They had a backup in the Gulf of Mexico, not too far from Pensacola, in the Gulf of Mexico. So that's the story. Rich, back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it. WB2GX, I'm clear.
Yeah, that's the way they're going to go. Starliner is being built by Boeing, and that's the one that they're going to test again. I mentioned before it's going to go to the International Space Station, and then return. That thing's going to land on land. In fact, the last one that had problems with also came down and landed on land. New Mexico, near White Sands, New Mexico. So they come down again, heat shield, parachutes, heat shield, and then right at the end, it's got these six big airbags, elongated airbags. Six of them will pop open on the bottom of the spacecraft, and they're going to land that way in the New Mexico. So that's a little different. Orion is going to be similar to Dragon, except they plan on bringing them back in the Pacific Ocean whenever they get around to launching people on Orion. That's still probably a couple of years away. Let me drop it. Definitely, Shan, go ahead.
I just sent a link to Dr. Roy. With picture of that hole, and from the explanation, the picture from the article that I sent link to, it looks like the hole wasn't hidden. It was very much exposed hole. When I look and get it, it's a close to quarter of an inch hole made by dual drill bit and a hand that wasn't really trained in drilling. There are several scratches on it, and what it says in here is that it happened, that was discovered before December 30th of 2018. The small hole in the Russian Soyuz spacecraft was found, that was sealed with bubble gum. And there are two Russian astronauts, Oleg Kononenko and Sergei Prokopyev. They went out to the space, outside of the spacecraft, and they took images of that hole after they took thermal isolation, and meteorite shield from the spacecraft. But interesting here is another article that I didn't send to you yet. The oligarch Dmitry Rogozin, who is the head of a Russian space program, who makes three times that much money as the American a businessman who is doing a better job right now in space. And he says that a leak on the International Space Station might have been sabotage, according to the head of Russian Roscosmos Space Agency investigation crew. Dmitry Rogozin said that hole was detected Thursday in Russian Soyuz module, that was 2018, dug to ISS, and was caused by the drill from inside of the spacecraft. There were several attempts of drilling, so it wasn't one. Rogozin said that late on Monday in televised comments that drill appears to have been held by wavering hands, that is a product of the fact or some premeditated action, he said. They were also checking the Earth version, thinking about sabotage in Earth, but you probably know better than I how old is that module, and if we have a quarter of inch at the atmospheric pressure hole, how much of air could be loose? Probably the bubble gum was also Russian made. It was good holding. So that fact is definitely proven, and it's nothing that is propaganda or the conspiracy theory. There was a NASA spokeswoman who referred all questions to the Russian Space Agency, which is overseeing a commission analysis, and there was no direct answer from Rogozin or from any representative of it. There was, till today, no explanation or no information about investigation that was taking place. But it was said by Russian Prime Minister that cosmonauts was probably psychologically disturbed and they have done it early before return home. So it looks like there was one of Russian astronauts who knows that a few minutes from that point he's gonna be out of the space station, and he wanted to do that sabotage. President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and his right hand Maxim Zhurayev were trying to put this information on silent, but obviously that information went out. Thank you very much. My question is, when that new module of ISS, Russian module called Nauka, which is science, will be detached? When the old module will be detached and when the new one will be touched in?
Okay, Wesley. I take everything that Radichin, that he's in charge of Roscosmos, with a grain of salt. I mean, originally he was saying, well, somebody, one of the astronauts probably did it. He was probably looking to blame one, Cassidy. Chris Cassidy was the commander at the time. He would have blamed anybody. But I'm not going by anything. And like I said, that module has been destroyed, never reentered. The new leak has to do, that's what the Zvezda, that's the big 40-foot long module is. That's up there that they use for eating and sleeping. And I'm sure that's fatigue, but I haven't seen it yet. And that's not a hole, from what I understand. That's a hairline crack. So we're talking about two different things, but we'll have to see. Let's face it, that drill, whoever drilled that, it was either done by accident or on purpose. Either one of the two. Can't imagine that somebody would have done this on purpose. In Russia, I'm sure whoever it is going to admit it. I think they have different laws there than we have. The guy would have been in a heap of trouble. My guess is it was probably one of a young technician. He drilled a couple holes there. It was right behind the bathroom area. I can envision the guy, the guy in charge saying, "We have to attach this to the wall." Okay, drill a couple holes over there, and the guy probably put a long bit on there. Okay, we'll drill a couple holes, and he probably went through and probably didn't tell anybody. That scenario, accident or somebody did it on purpose, I doubt it. And then bubblegum, I haven't heard that. They did send up material to the
not bubble gum. I'm sure they could write anything, you know, anything they want. But that sounds pretty far-fetched. I guess it's possible, but I doubt it. From what I understand, Cassidy was involved with making sure that it was done correctly. And I don't think NASA would go along with bubble gum. Let me drop it.
So what I'm saying is the Russians were trying to hide that before they announced that there was a leak, and they used the bubble gum for it. Now, Dr. Roy has the article and has the photograph of several attempts of drilling, and it's pretty obvious that one hole is done and you could see it. Dr. Roy.
I'll post it on the link page.
I've seen the pictures months ago. I saw what it looked like on the inside. But that doesn't tell me anything. The Nokia, I was going to talk about that later, the module that will be going up is scheduled for next year. Again, that doesn't mean anything. It was scheduled for 12 years ago. That thing has been delayed year in, year out. But hopefully they get it up there next year. I was going to mention Arecibo as well. You know, I heard you talking about that. But Arecibo will be decommissioned. They have these massive cables. And the diameter is 3 inches. And one of them broke last August. And then another one just let go recently. And they've decided to decommission Arecibo. And that is, of course, that famous radio telescope that's been in movies before. They've used it on a James Bond movie. I particularly liked it on the Contact movie with the Contact, book and eventually movie done by Carl Sagan, one of my favorite astronomers. Very good movie called Contact movie, and they show very good pictures of it, what it looks like below it, down into it. But it has done transmitting. In fact, it did a transmission for SETI back in the mid-90s for NASA cut off funding to NASA for any SETI involvement. They did do a transmission. They pointed it toward Lyra and the constellation Lyra and transmitted away. Had a couple of symbols, if you could convert the signals into what it looks like. It would look like a person. So basically, they sent the transmission out that I don't know how many terawatts was blown out of this thing. But it's traveling through space. And I think they said it would get to the first planet if there was a planet around this one star. At the time, no extraterrestrial planets were even proven yet when they transmitted this. But if it got to one, it would be
at the time,
around 28 years or so. So if there's a civilization there and they hear it, we got roughly another 50 years or 60 years before we hear back that it worked. But they did transmit out of that. What they do transmit on a regular basis is radar. Like Roy said, they look for the characteristics of asteroids. And the big asteroid that's been in the news lately for NASA has been Bennu. That's the one that got visited by OSIRIS-REx, we covered her extensively in the last couple of weeks. OSIRIS-REx is the one with the robotic arm that came out and had this round device that would touch the surface of the asteroid. And they have nitrogen bottles. The valve opens up and shoots nitrogen out. And disturbs the soil, and then it actually gets sucked up back into this round
air filter looking device. It's like an air filter on a 327 Chevy engine, you know. So the robotic device or robotic arm put this collector. They called it the tag unit, TAG, touch and go, and then they put it into this hermetically sealed setup. The robotic arm separated from this circular thing that now has all the material in it, and then it closed. The piece itself closed. Now it's completely encapsulated in this defense module, which will eventually be sent back to Earth 2023. Army proving ground, almost like a desert out there in Utah. And anyway, Arecibo took pictures of Bennu early on. They suspected that this was a place that the astronomers, people looking for the scientists, where they wanted to eventually go. And Arecibo took pictures, and you can see the shape of it in the picture. I should have sent that over to Dr. Roy, but you can see that was one of the purposes of Arecibo. In fact, I think they did an interferometry deal with Goldstone. Goldstone has a tannery as well. I think they teamed up with them to get this detailed picture of Bennu. Bennu is this asteroid that stands a little higher than World Trade Center. It would have been that big, a couple thousand feet. And it was shaped like it's not round, it's more like a big square. So, there you go. Arecibo had a lot of purpose. Did a lot of that type of work when they needed to investigate something. It wouldn't go looking for asteroids. It wasn't that type of thing. They would know where an asteroid was, and they would point the... They would make sure this antenna was facing in that direction. At the time, of course, the antenna itself didn't move, but they did have the capability of moving the focal point around above the antenna to, change locations. They didn't have to, they weren't locked into one particular point of the sky. They could go up a few degrees one way or the other with Arecibo. So anyway, that's going to be destroyed in this kind of climate with the administration that we have now that does not believe in science. I have not heard a word about rebuilding. I know they're going to demolish it, but, just build another one, with more modern stuff. Probably make everything a lot lighter, a lot less expensive. This thing was made, 60 years ago. So we've come a long way since then. Why should China have the biggest antenna? They have something called, I think it's called the FAST. And that thing is actually bigger than Arecibo in diameter. I think that was like 1,500 feet diameter. So, we should beat that. Maybe put one up in the same place. Make some bigger. Any questions? WS2F. Okay, well, alright, let me just we're going over time a little bit, but maybe I should go over and do that Nokia topic. Nokia is the module, it's a big module, around 43 feet long and 14 feet in diameter. It's big. It's got docking ports on it. It's going to have another bathroom. It's going to have plenty of science locations to do science in it. And it's developed by the Russians. And like I said earlier, it was supposed to go up about 12 years ago. All kinds of problems with the, they waited too long and they had to take out all the old engines and piping. And just redo everything over and over again. but now it seems to be ready to go. And the location they need to put it on is in a location that's already occupied by the Piers docking module. There's module bed, and very relatively small. They can do